Welcome to the program for Friday, November 15th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The 4 o'clock hour on Friday is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week it is Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service. It's great to see you as always, my friend.
Always great to be here.
And Dale Myros, the president of the Myros Group. My friend, welcome to the studio again. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Francis.
You have each chosen what you think are the three most important federal news stories of the week, and they're great selections as always. We'll put them later at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we start where we always do with...
Number three!
Tim McManus, your third most important story is headlined, Report Says Data Projects Need to Show Payoff, and that's from the Federal Times, Sean Riley's story in Fed Times. The agencies are spending a lot of money on big data and trying to figure out how they could leverage it, but we're still waiting to see the ROI on a lot of these things from what it sounds like.
Well, waiting to see what the ROI is, but also trying to determine what the information is even saying is kind of the first step in that. So, you know, we were talking before the show started, which is, you know, in a lot of cases, agencies even who have been trying to look at big data for a while have been taking hordes and hordes and reams of paper to leaders and saying, here's the data. But they're not taking the next step to actually say, here's what the data actually means so that we can figure out whether or not we're making progress and really trying to determine what the ROI on that is. So again, leaders are having a hard time deciphering what the data means. Are we actually making any progress? And if we are, what's kind of the result of that? Or what's the cause of that?
There's a one step in between that I think we're maybe not thinking about, Dale, and that's the collation of the data. You can have the stack of data, as Tim's talking about, and we see that. But before you even get to the analytic phase, it strikes me that it's got to be kind of organized, shaped somehow, so that you know what's even available for you to analyze.
Absolutely. And oftentimes we get stuck in this idea of big data that that's a technical thing. Well, big data is actually a use thing, not a technical thing. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, most of the data that our organizations use is open source data. So how do you combine the open source data with your proprietary data to create your differentiation, your specialty, the things that take care of your mission?
Is there a silver lining here, Tim, as far as the amount of data that agencies have? Because they generate more and more all the time. And there are a lot of people, especially on the vendor side, believe that the arc of understanding to collection is growing faster than the agencies can keep up with it.
So I think that's probably right, that the arc is growing faster than agencies can keep up with it. Clearly, agencies are collecting more and more. One of the key questions that this report from Data to Decisions 2 that the partnership released shows, though, is that are they actually focused on the right data? So another issue there is, are they focused on the right? So again, you get these hordes of data points in, but if you're not looking at or collecting the right things to begin with, you know, you may be chasing a rabbit down a rabbit hole. So I think that's still one of the things that agencies are still struggling with, is determining what the right data is that actually gets them to the point of figuring out what's our return and as a result of this, what's our path forward.
What I'm finding out is that the guys on the technical side don't really put enough work in the management stack. And it's through that management stack that they can sift through the mountains of data and pull out the relevant ones. Like I used to say in the intelligence community, our job's not to protect secrets, it's to use secrets. Protecting them and the use of them is the business of getting value out of it. But it doesn't do any good to have all that data if you can't use it.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim McManus as the Fed Times story. Data projects need to show payoff. And we'll put a link to that partnership report along with this news story on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Tim. Dale, your third most important federal news story of the week is from Information Week. The headline is, How Will You Manage Your Digital Self? And it really gets to a point that it's people in the media, some of my colleagues are trying to figure out. We're creating more stuff than we can ever possibly keep track of. And it kind of fits with what Tim was just talking about a moment ago. And the realization strikes me that we're kind of the same place as what you and I have talked about in the past about cyber. You can't protect everything from everybody, so it becomes a risk management proposition. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. There are two major points I'd like to put out right at front, and I'm going to have a recurring theme, art of the possible or fear of the inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is the art of the possible. And we're always looking for future indicators. You know, a lot of us are still stuck in the mode of I'm going to sit back and wait for the requirements to come or whatever. And lo and behold, the business about things like PDAs and the iPhone and all that other kind of good stuff just hits agencies upside the head. Well, you got to look for future indicators, and I think this is one. And so you have to think about people as creating their, and how do you manage those digital cells? And the article points out that that Forrester and some of the think tanks are already considering the elements of how data is created, whether it's mutual, whether it's received, whether it's compiled, whether it's recorded, monitored, all of those other kinds of things. And so our people and our organizations will have digital cells. And typically the organizations even today think of the data being detached from individuals. No, individuals will have profiles, and the data will be associated with the profile and the activities of particular individuals, and that will generate. And so I think we have to think about how we manage that data in a different way.
This article gets at something that I think is really at the essence of the way agencies should think about how they're interacting with citizens, because this is ultimately what people are going to demand from their government. Tim, three forces will heat up the competition when it comes to serving people. And how they think of their digital selves. A drive to aggregate, combine, and orchestrate across multiple services to make new features possible. A desire to get closer to the customer's core needs. That's number two. And number three, the ability to drive new business models and gather customers and masses of data to make money from advertising and premium services. Now, of course, we know governments aren't in the business of making money, but there are some parallels there, it seems to me, as to how governments should think about serving citizens and providing the services that citizens expect.
Well, I think it's not only how they're providing services to citizens, but also some of their business operations, too. So you look at it from my vantage point and the work that I'm doing at the Partnership for Public Service around recruiting and hiring. How do you look at it that same way as you're actually, you know, tracking who's coming in, who's leaving, why are they leaving? You are beginning to create that digital profile of individuals as well. If you're doing things right, that's the way you ought to be looking at it. Who are the successful folks coming into your agencies? What are their characteristics? What are they bringing with them that make them successful? That's really another offshoot of this. So I think, yeah, some of it is their customer-focused perspective, which clearly we all know agencies need to do a better job of focusing on the customer as well. But part of it is also how do they use this to actually enhance some of their basic operational functions?
What Tim is getting at, I think, is a great point, Dale, and that is that agencies are thinking about their external customers, and I hear them use the word customers now more than ever before. That's a great sign. But they have internal customers too, and thinking about that relationship sounds like it's kind of at the core of what Tim's getting at.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I put this article out there because it would cause us to think ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And so in today's environment, the digital self is largely an access and store function. Okay, within the next 2 or 3 years, it's going to be in this manage function, you know, this bridge between the activity of the people in your organization to your customers exterior and vice versa. And then probably after we figure out the business of manage, we got to figure out the business of integrating the digital cells within the organization in order to anticipate the needs of what our organizations will need and do.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dale Myros, is from Information Week. How will you manage your digital self? And the piece contains some suggestions about what that might look like in the future. You can read it and all of our stories later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dale Myros and by Tim McManus, next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Dale Myros, the Myros Group. And Dale, we are up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as you selected, is from Politico. The headline is FTC Wading into the Internet of Things. And I couldn't help but think, as I read this story, it looks like they're trying to avoid the "we're from the government, we're here to help" syndrome. And I wonder, since the idea of the Internet of Things is so new, whether it may be too soon or maybe too late for them to get involved in this concept.
Well, I think that's a great observation. Again, I'm revisiting my theme of the fear of the inevitable, and this definitely is the fear of the inevitable. Mm-hmm. And we've got largely an unregulated portion of free enterprise, as it were, in the business of, like you appropriately say, the concept's not really been deployed. It's talked a lot about and all those kinds of things. But I think that we're going to very quickly end up with a very frictional piece of what's the role of the government versus what's the role of free enterprise. And as you know, there's the element of freedom of choice and innovation is often seen at odds with regulation and oversight and bureaucracy. And this is a perfect example, I think, you know, particularly as we start thinking about smart grids, smart homes, smart offices, and so forth.
The chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission, Edith Ramirez, is quoted in this Politico story saying, technology is just developing at a pace that we can barely keep up with. We need to be conscious of this, and it absolutely needs further study. I certainly want to make sure the agency, the FTC, is looking at all these developments. Tim, everything, it seems, in the whole world is going to be connected to the Internet at some point. I just saw a thing for home security systems, which I thought was a wild idea until one of my colleagues here said, yeah, that's been around for like 5 years. Where have I been? Living under a rock, no big surprise. But this is something that this is a policy issue that it seems to me is particularly tricky right now because it transcends partisanship. There's not an ideological thing here, but it is certainly something that they have to pay attention to while at the same time being not too careful to kind of stand in the way of or overregulate.
So I think that is the key, which is, you know, how do you actually keep pace? Can you keep pace? And clearly I think a lot of government as a whole is having a hard time keeping pace. You know, quite frankly, folks in other sectors are having a hard time keeping pace as well. So part of it is keeping with pace. Again, to the earlier conversation that we had with our number three stories is, how do you actually stay ahead of the pace as well? How are you looking not simply at what's going on now? Because we can look at policy and regulation as it is in the here and now, but if we're only keeping pace with where it is, tomorrow we're behind the eight ball again. Mm-hmm. So it's really being able to look further out to say, where is this going and what's the ramifications and how do we actually create regulation or policy that not affects us today but affects us 5, 10, 15 years from now? I think that's actually the bigger challenge than the here and now.
Well, that's especially complicated, Tim, when you see things like in this story. The FTC made a foray into the Internet of Things in September, settling a case against TrendNet, a maker of Internet-connected home security cameras, and the essence of this deal was they weren't protecting their networks well enough, and it was possible for hackers to get in and watch what's going on inside my house. And when you think about the concept of a home security system on the Internet, hackers isn't the first thing I think of, but boy, it probably should be.
Oh, absolutely. And that story, along with a couple other quotes in here, brings to mind that very quickly there are four things I think we need to look at. And the first is do we need a new law, or is modification of an existing one good enough? And we sometimes do one and hop to the other, as everybody knows. Are we looking at a consent by exception or an opt-in? And again, it's a different approach, you know, as to how you think about it. Then I think it's the element of there are things that are obvious, you know, the business about Social Security numbers, identity. Okay, some of the things not so obvious about is what about the temperature within my house or, you know, whether the knobs turned or not turned, all those aren't quite so obvious as far as being critical.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, in the Internet of Things, are we going to have a different set of rules and standards for the public sector versus the private sector? Because, you know, our technical folks in our government organizations are going to end up dealing with this as well. And so does there need to be a cutout for the public side that the private sector might not have? Those are all issues.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dale Myros, is from Politico. The headline is FTC wading into Internet of Things. Tim, your second most important story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Government Could Save Billions by Reducing Federal Pay and Benefits. And we see an example of this that is not included in this story, but we have it up on federalnewsradio.com this afternoon. Senator Coburn leading a group of senators to change the way that the federal benefits package looks to new hires by eliminating the defined benefit pension. The idea that is outlined in this piece is attractive because of the headline, could save billions of dollars. And boy, the government would love to do nothing more right now than save billions of dollars.
So, and probably needs to look at saving billions of dollars. The question here is this the place to actually save the billions of dollars? You may be able to save billions of dollars long term. I'm actually concerned that focusing on these areas that are outlined here, really around reducing pay, kind of redefining benefits and pension plans, it may actually give you a very short-term gain, but the long-term loss could be astronomical for government. So if we look at changing the pension plan for people coming in, how much of a detriment then is that or a barrier to getting good people into government? If, in fact, we look at continued suppression of pay, how many of the folks that are in government actually decide, good folks in government say, you know what, this is no longer worth it. I'm actually headed to the private sector. I'm headed to the nonprofit sector. And you're losing, you basically have a brain drain.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the flip side, can you actually, with that pay and benefits, can you bring people back in again? So I think a lot of these, yeah, they're attractive because it's a short-term, big-dollar fix. At the same time, I think we've got to be really careful about the long-term ramifications of this and make sure that there's a strategy behind it beyond simply we're going to save money. And I think that's actually, you know, if you look at corporations when they go through bad times, what do? They do just what government's looking at right now. Let's lay off people. Let's reduce our workforce. Well, what happens? At some point in time, they're actually paying the piper for that, either because they have to pay more to bring folks back in or they no longer can do something that they're already that they're doing right now. So again, I think we have to be strategic about the way that we look at these things and not just say, okay, we can cut $265 billion, let's do it.
The key word there, as it is so many other places in government, Dale, though, is strategic, because one of the things that some members have asked for, Senator Coburn's one of them, is just a straight-up inventory of everything that agencies are doing and the reason that they're doing it, i.e. point us back to the legislation that told you to do it. And that's not clear. And it strikes me that I'm certainly not suggesting that's an easy thing to do. It's going to be difficult and it would take time. But that seems to me that if you then have a baseline of everything that everybody's doing, then you could theoretically get to some kind of a position where you have a negotiation about, do we need to continue to do this or should somebody else be doing this? Or we can look at the GAO reports that indicate that some things are happening 7 or 8 different places in government and it only has to happen one. All of those kinds of conversations that aren't happening right now that could be the groundwork for that strategy that Tim's talking about.
I think that's exactly right, Francis. But as you know, there are these bureaucratic tendencies that creep in. And the first thing is, well, this shouldn't be part of the baseline. This is an exception. Mm-hmm. So bureaucracies will tend to, you know, when Congress or the Hill comes out and tries to set definitions, bureaucracies often react with saying, well, that definition doesn't apply to this portion of what we do. But I think this plays over into subjects that have this cyclical nature within our government. Reduction in force. Do you really reduce in force or do you attrit? And then once you've attrited or reduced in force and you find out that there are key services that you've omitted, now you outsource. And then you're in a period of time where outsourcing becomes many of your solutions, and then you look around like we have several times here in the recent past and said, we're relying on contractors too much. How did we get in that position? So back to your point, Francis, the strategic outlook is what's key, and that's what is hardest for our government to do.
I'm encouraged, I must say, gentlemen, by the fact, though, that I hear that conversation happening more often, especially in the HR world in government now, than I ever have before. And a lot of people are looking at what happened in the 90s and the kind of the trough that we created in the federal workforce, where we have you experienced it in the IC to a terrific extent, Dale, where you had a whole lot of veterans and a whole lot of people who were new to the organization and not much in between.
Nobody in between.
That's right. And so at least there is an understanding in the executive branch side, a comprehension, Tim, that that kind of thing has happened before, and it's not desirable. It's part of the reason we're in the spot we're in now. So what do we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again?
Yeah, so I'd like to be as optimistic as what you just painted. I actually won't give government as much credit of thinking through this as you're actually doing right now. And I think, you know, part of that is that by and large, I still feel like agencies are very reactive to situations, and particularly as it relates to their workforce, they're very much reactive to things. The second piece is, again, to put that word strategy back in, or strategic, I just don't always see that happening. So, you know, we talk about maybe right sizing government through attrition as well. You know, we're not looking at that again from a strategy perspective, saying, are some areas, it may be okay in some areas for us to lose folks and not replace. In other areas, we simply can't do that. And that's not the conversation. Instead, the conversation is, if we lose folks, we just won't replace them across the board. So I think, again, I think we may be getting a little further down the road, and I think certainly lessons from the past are coming into play, but I still think there's a gap here in terms of the way that folks are looking at their workforce and how they manage it appropriately. And again, you mentioned reduction in forces, but you know, there are some legislative and regulatory barriers that are at play as well. So the last in, first out, is that really the best way to manage your workforce? I don't know that it is. But that's the way it has to be managed right now, because that's actually what loss is.
We just have a minute or so left, but this also fits with something you and I have talked about before, which is the idea that when somebody leaves, you don't necessarily need to fill that job again. You may, your workforce needs in 2013 might be different than they were in 2008 or, you know, 1978 when that person started or whatever. And that's the part of another aspect of this strategic concept that I do see is missing from time to time.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think the key to this is, again, government needs to figure out ways that it can reduce its expenses. Also, maybe some ways to generate additional revenue as well. And where do those two actually collide? Because there are instances right now that we're actually going through right now where you look at an organization like IRS, who revenue through the IRS is down. Well, in part it's down because they've actually got less folks who are actually out there collecting back taxes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we again, it's about strategy and how do we link those up. And clearly there may be some redundancies, but that's the place to actually look at and then make some strategic decisions.
We could have probably done the whole show just on this Congressional Budget Office analysis. It's the topic of Tim McManus's second most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown. It's a GovExec story headline, Government Could Save Billions by Reducing Federal Pay and Benefits. And it's linked, like all of our stories on the Countdown, later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Number one, the top of the chart next when we come back with Tim McManus and Dale Myros on this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service, Dale Myros of the Myros Group, and we are up to the top of the chart.
Number one!
Dale, your most important federal news story of the week is a selection from Dark Reading. The headline is Chinese APT campaigns may be more connected than previously thought. And there's an understatement in this piece that I will give the understatement of the week award. The discovery, detailed in a new report published by FireEye, lends more evidence that Chinese APT operations are well-resourced and organized. Wow! What a newsflash! The Chinese government is really good at organizing and executing cyber attacks. Yeah. I had no idea.
Exactly. The thing that I'm finding in a lot of discussions is that the Chinese threat has been around and been constant for so long, we're almost a little bit immune to it. Mm-hmm. And so I think this article brings up a couple of points that bear some rethinking. First of all, again, it's the fear of the inevitable. What is the role of government with regard to critical infrastructure? As you and I have talked many times, 80 to 90% of critical infrastructure in the United States is in private ownership. So, what role does our government have in protecting critical infrastructure? Second thing, it points out that the Chinese are really in the business of industrial espionage. Yes, they do target the United States government, but they are really after the economic fabric of our country and after industry. And so when we as either in the government work in this situation or outside of the government as a part of it, we need to remember that the target definitely is cyber espionage. And so things like malware, supply chain integrity, all those kinds of things that are so important to combating advanced persistent threats, not the hacking business, because that really has gone to the back of the bus, as it were. You know, this is the preferred methodology of infiltration and exfiltration of information.
There was one passage in this piece that did catch me a little bit by surprise. It says researchers at Mandiant, meanwhile, and that's the company, of course, that put out the big report in February or March, I believe, that detailed down to the building where this espionage was happening in China and how. Researchers at Mandiant concur some APT groups appear to share resources but say they aren't convinced there's an actual offensive organization that provides the tools to the attackers. People that study China a lot more closely than I do tell me that nothing goes on in China without the either explicit or implicit approval of the Chinese government. And this seems to me that it would be exactly the same. I mean, certainly maybe not everybody knows exactly what everybody's doing, but what I would deduct from this is that the Chinese government certainly doesn't mind that this is going on if they know about it.
Absolutely. And as you and I have talked before, in the past I've been very reluctant to talk about Chinese and Chinese threat and things like that because the elements of classification. Well, now it's more public. Mm-hmm. It's out there. And I think in this particular case, Mandiant was looking for that compelling case of every I dotted and T crossed. And so I think that was the gist of their answer there, not necessarily whether or not they believe that there's real cyber aggression going on here.
I see a connection, Tim, although I know you're not a cyber guy and you're a people guy. There's an important quotient here that fits the theme of all the people things that we've talked about before, because we need humans no matter what the technology is that we have to defend with or what we have to defend against. We need the humans to be able to operate that technology, and the government struggling with that right now.
Yeah, and in part they're struggling. As Dale said, you know, 90% of this is actually non-governmental, right? So when you then put government in the mix and say government needs good cybersecurity folks, well, are they left with the 10% there that aren't going to the private sector? And that can't be the case. So a good colleague, I'll call him a colleague of mine from the Office of Science and Technology Policy, this doesn't relate to cyber, but it actually relates to STEM talent in general. When we talk about pipelines and availability of talent and everything else, one of the things that he often says is, I don't care if there's 50 million people who actually have who have a background in cyber, or there's five people. Does government have its fair share of those five people? And I think that's actually the question mm-hmm. in this as it relates to people as well. Government might not be able to get, you know, the bulk of folks because that's not where the bulk of this is actually happening. But do they have their fair market share of the great talent that's out there, not just the leftover talent that isn't going to the private sector?
I like that concept, Dale. I like the way that Tim expresses that because I'm not sure that's how we're approaching it. It strikes me that I see more people in government thinking about just how do we get bodies in that are qualified. And the idea of attracting the very best people is something to aspire to, but I'm not sure that it's top of mind given the way that we've had to operate the last couple of years.
Well, isn't it interesting how this topic relates back to Tim's previous article mm-hmm. about pay and compensation
yep.
and all those kinds of things?
Yep.
And so there, you know, there's a two-edged sword here that says while you save billions in one place, you have, you know, your entire capability force walk out the door on the other. And so that's why, again, your point on in the last segment about a strategic outlook is hugely important. 75% of the people ages 17 to 24 in our country are unfit for military service. That means that the government, the military, and all of industry is competing for the same 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And like Tim says, will the government be able to compete and get the right part, their part share of that 25%?
Yeah, you gave me credit for being a little more optimistic than you. And as this conversation continues, Tim, I'm starting to change my thoughts a little bit. It sounds like it's a lot more daunting proposal than it did a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and I hate to be the pessimist either on this because I think there are things
we'll call you the realist.
So the good thing is, I think there are things that government can do, but it actually has to, again, it has has to make a concerted effort to say, this is actually really important to us. It's actually important to the future of this country. It's important. And therefore, we're going to invest in it. And again, I think that's what you see. If you look at really good nonprofits, you look at really good private sector companies, what do? They invest in their people. And that doesn't just mean once they walk in the door, they invest in them. They invest in making sure they get the good people in the door to begin with. And then how do they hang on to them? And frankly, they also recognize that they may not be able to hang on to them forever. That's okay. Flow out is okay as long as we're getting good flow back in again. So I think, you know, you mentioned earlier, going back maybe to even the 70s and dusting off the job description of somebody who's left. We're in a very different world now. We've actually got to look at talent a whole lot differently.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dale Myros, is from Dark Reading. It is headlined, Chinese APT campaigns may be more connected than previously thought. And you can read it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown, linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown with Tim McManus's most important federal news story of the week next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week selected by Dale Myros and Tim McManus. And Tim, your most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com that is headlined, Archuleta looks to forge a new pathway to better engage federal workforce. And when I saw that you selected this story, I couldn't decide if you selected it because of the content of the story, which, thanks to Jack, is fantastic, or if you selected it because of the terrific play on words that Miss Archuleta used. Do you think she used the word, she said the words, I want to forge a new pathway forward on purpose? Or did she just kind of use that word, not understanding that you and I have talked about the Pathways program about 9,000 times in the past year?
Yeah, I think probably not related to our 9,000 conversations about the Pathways programs. But really chose it for the topic, chose it because clearly it was a Federal News Radio story as well.
And, that's nice.
And then also I had the opportunity to attend this Open Chico meeting as well. So I was actually there to hear the conversation myself.
The idea that she wants to recreate or revamp the way that employees feel connected to their work is, the timing couldn't be better with the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey coming out last week and not looking so hot. And you're going to have more, you and your colleagues at the partnership will analyze those numbers fantastically as you do every year. But in addition to the timing, the sentiment, I think, is important, too, because we still, a month after people are coming back from the shutdown, are still hearing about morale issues, are still hearing about people thinking about, do I want to keep doing this or not? And not even just retirement, not people who are at the ends of their careers, all the people that are in the middles of their careers, that we want to be the GS-15s and the SESers at some point in the future, they're going, I don't really know if this is for me.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we were talking at the break about when somebody comes in, set your priorities. I think she was looking at the landscape of where we are right now, and it just happened to coincide with OPM's release of the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey data. But she made a conscious decision coming in saying, one of my priorities, given the last probably year and a half, has to be around building employee morale and building the perception not only within government but outside of government that the work that government workers are doing is valuable and it needs to be praised, not denigrated. Mm-hmm. And I think she recognized that and again, Dale, to the conversation we had, has said, what's my legacy going to be? Part of my legacy has to be around improving the way that federal employees are viewed and their engagement in the system as well. And by the way, if we're ever going to get better, the only way to get better is to engage the employees.
The communications thing is what's really important here, Dale. And we've talked about this in the past, another issue that you and I have covered. This article, Jack writes about some of the ways that some of the Chicos across government are talking about engaging their employees. That can be a lot more effective than I think people give that concept credit for, just engaging with people and letting them know that you just give a dang about what they're doing and how they're doing it. It's certainly not going to make up for pay freezes and all of the other jazz that we talk about, But just the fact that they know that you're going to be looking at them and thinking about them is just critical.
Oh, absolutely. I was in the government for three and a half decades, and what I noticed over time is that more and more employees expected to hear, they expected to be in on what's happening and why. So the rationale for a lot of decisions from the top needed to get out there, and that was as important as what the decision was. As you know, I moved from the Air Force to the intelligence community, and so had the opportunity to come in as a political appointee. And how do you pick what those one, two, or three, no more than three things you're going to emphasize your first day? I've come to modify that a little bit. That says that, you know, you're working a journey, you're working a process, you're working an outcome, you're working some aspect. And my analogy is a road. So you need to make a decision. Do I need to patch the potholes in this road? Or do I need to do something more drastic and repave this road? Or do I need to do something transformational and build a new road to a new destination?
Mm-hmm.
And that is really key. Realizing that I just described, very vast differences between, you know, patching holes and building a new road. But you have to figure out how you get there and how you get that communication accomplished.
To use Dale's analogy, Tim, it sounds like Miss Archuleta is at least open to the idea of building some new roads if she has the opportunity to do it.
I think she's actually looking at all, based on the conversation that took place in this Open Chico meeting, she's actually open to looking at all of those options and really trying to figure out and help agencies figure out. Because, again, part of it is on OPM, part of it is on each and every individual agency. So she's actually, I think, helping to bring the conversation to the agencies about what is it that you need to do? Fill the pothole, which may be focus on places that you're already strong in terms of engaging. And I think one of the things that I saw there was the engagement, and it was reflected in this article, the engagement of the Chicos in terms of what they're trying, what's working, what's not working. So again, I'm trying to fill the pothole. That's really not working. I need to repave the entirety. Oh, I may actually need to go in a completely different direction. So I think all of that is really key. And again, the conversation that took place was pretty incredible. I think the one piece that we can't undersell here is that the Chief Human Capital Officers and OPM is really pushing now on how do we better engage our employees and drive that satisfaction up, which if we can do that, productivity, everything else goes along with that. I think the question that all of those Chief Human Capital Officers have to ask, OPM have to ask, is how do we go beyond the HR community as well, though? Because if we look at our best places to work in the federal government rankings, the number one key driver of employee engagement is leadership. So how do you've got to expand that conversation beyond those folks who people is their sole responsibility to managers and leaders whose responsibility is actually leading people so that they're engaged in this process trying to figure out, am I putting some more concrete or blacktop in the pothole?
So you and I have talked about the concept of management versus leadership and the tendency of the government to promote people who are technically proficient rather than those who demonstrate leadership ability. Dale, are there lessons that your friends on the civilian side in the federal government can learn from you and your colleagues, military and former military, about developing leaders as opposed to just promoting the next person in line?
Absolutely. Well, the concept of leadership versus management, you know, leadership is doing the right things. Management is doing things right. Now, you can't have one without the other. I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship. But doing things individually right doesn't necessarily get you the right destination all the time. And the digital immigrants are in the process of leaving the workforce. And so the workforce is going to be filled with those born digital, raised digital, and all those other kinds of things. And so this idea of communication, this idea of what motivates them, and all those other kinds of things that we're used to with the workforce that is currently leaving, and a large part of our workforce is capable of leaving at any point in time, mm-hmm. if they want to, you know, like Francis talked about earlier, in many of our agencies, there's a bathtub, if you will, in the middle ranks, middle management of lack of people, because we've lost them over the years because we failed to think strategically.
Do you see anything on the horizon? We just have a minute or so left, Tim. Do you see anything on the horizon to kind of give us either a little patch or a solution to that leadership versus management problem?
So I don't know that there's necessarily a quick fix patch, but again, I think you know first we've got to ingrain in our leaders and in our managers that people actually matter. And I think part of the way to ingrain that in them is to take Department of Transportation as an example. With all of their SES folks, they've actually included measures in their performance appraisals that relate directly back to the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey. They're holding their managers and leaders accountable for engaging their employees. Okay, We've got to hold people accountable.
But real quick, are you confident they're giving those managers and leaders the tools that they need to deliver on that, or are they just going to mark them and hold them up from being able to actually do it successfully?
So if you look at the scores of the Department of Transportation on the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey, those scores are actually going up.
Okay.
So I'd say, yes, they're getting the tools, or they're being empowered to actually make those changes.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim McManus. It's Jack Moore's story for federalnewsradio.com. Archuleta looks to forge a new pathway to better engage the federal workforce. You can find it and all of our countdown stories this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dale Myros, Tim McManus, a wonderful countdown. Thank you very much for your selections and for being here to do it today. It's great to have both of you on the program as always.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you.